You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 15th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to talk about his newest book, The Sublime and Terrifying Inside Story of Obama's Final Campaign, Michael Hastings, reporter. Is he still at BuzzFeed? At BuzzFeed. Also on the program today, Zero Dark 30 gets wide release. Is it propaganda? I don't know. What's propaganda? What? It's just a movie that just purports to tell the real story of how we got Osama bin Laden and then attributed a lot of it to torture when, in fact, that wasn't the case. What are you gonna do? More stories. Couple of interesting stories on the media front. The Atlantic blurring that line between ads and not ads. Incidentally, folks, we'll be doing a 10-minute segment today on the success of Scientology. May or may not be paid. Maybe it's been a banner year. Republicans working hard to get their members to stop justifying horrible rape comments. Not kidding. Some of the debt ceiling. All that and more on the program today. I thought this was sort of a funny story, just a light story to start the day off. Rick Scott, when he is not lying about Medicaid costs, when he's not pleading the fifth in investigations in his company's defrauding Medicare or Medicaid, when his company's not paying literally, what is it, over $1 billion in fines, what are you going to do? Rick Scott apparently is lying about other things. Just a fascinating story. This coming out of, I guess it's the Times in Florida. Lucy Morgan, Tallahassee. Shortly after winning the GOP nomination in 2010, Rick Scott announced to the world through Facebook that his family had rescued a Labrador retriever. You know, they say you really need a dog if you're going to run for office. That's one of the things that their media consultants will tell them. And with help from his Facebook friends, Scott gave it a name, Reagan, of course. The Scott family is proud to announce that the name chosen by you for their newly adopted pup. It's a puppy. This is Reagan. Thanks to everyone who participated in the fun contest. And of course, the commenters were ecstatic. The right-wingers loved to see Reagan deified. The last time Reagan made the newspapers was the day before Scott was sworn in as governor in January of 2011. A reporter then for the News Service of Florida reported seeing the governor-elect walking with Reagan in Tallahassee. Apparently, a reporter last week, just for the heck of it, asked, "Hey, where's your dog?" to one of the communications directors, or the former one. And apparently the former communications director wouldn't answer the question. He's like, "I'm not going to waste my time answering such ridiculous questions." He accused the reporters of surfing some old Facebook or website pages. So, and then the former spokesperson referred all questions about the dog to Melissa Sellers, the governor's new communications director. Sellers, over the course of 2 days, said, "I'm far too busy to respond to questions about the dog." And then, apparently, the spokesman for the governor's wife also refused to answer the question and said that they only have one dog. Her name is Tally. She's a 7-year-old rescue lab. So on Monday, the Times asked the governor to clear up the mystery about the dog. Scott said, well, he was a rescue dog, and he couldn't be around anybody that was carrying anything, so he wouldn't get better. So they gave the dog away, but they don't know to whom. They're claiming that they're still trying to find, the governor's office on Monday told the Times it was still trying to find Reagan and its new family. There you have it. Rick Scott, folks, Lex Luthor, just the story of an archvillain and his dog.
Rick Scott, why do you hate Reagan?
Oh, my God.
Yes. Rick Scott has to be a performance sketch. Everything about him, it's just so, like, even a dog.
So odious. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Michael Hastings. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program writer for BuzzFeed and author of, well, at least one bestseller. We'll see about the second. The first one, of course, is The Operators. The second book just released or just about to, the sublime and terrifying inside story of Obama's final campaign entitled Panic 2012. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
So let's, before we start, we talk about the book, because it's fascinating to get stories of this campaign and to sort of, you know, one of the things people love to talk about is who is the real Obama and what is their campaign. But we'll sure. get to that in a minute, because I want to talk about you'd written last week about Zero Dark Thirty, and it's a film that's getting now a wide release. It purports to be the, well, I don't know, when it's based on real events, I guess, is the way that they sold this. I mean, a while back, yeah. they sold it as a true story. Now they're sort of like hedging a little bit.
Based on firsthand, actual firsthand accounts, I think, is the wording.
Firsthand actual accounts that may have a substantial vested interest in telling a story that isn't exactly the truth. Now, obviously the story is it starts back in 2001, maybe 2002, right. Really, and it starts off. I've watched, to be full disclosure, I've watched half the movie, and it starts essentially around the torture of a guy named Ahmed. Well, I can't remember the first guy that they've tortured here, but supposedly the first guy that they've tortured gives them a name of a courier who ultimately 10 years later, 8 years later, leads them to where Osama bin Laden is hiding out. Give us a sense, right, of what your understanding is that what role the CIA played in this in terms of telling the story.
Look, I think, you know, clearly the CIA played a pretty important role in gathering intelligence about bin Laden's location over, right, this 10-year period. That being said, you know, how much of that information that actually led to bin Laden was gone through enhanced interrogation, I think it doesn't sound like it was too significant. At least my understanding of everything I've read from everyone who's studied this, everyone I've talked to, everyone, people who've actually participated in enhanced interrogation, have said to me and obviously to others that it didn't play this sort of prime role. But there's the film itself leaves no doubt that torture is the reason we got bin Laden, and in fact mocks any kind of alternative explanation. Even though in the film itself, too, weirdly, at one point, and this is a spoiler alert, there's a scene where they're like, oh, yeah, that courier's name who we had to get through torture, we actually had that guy's name in a picture of him from October of 2001 from another intelligence source. So you know, but even you know, I have to say, I did sit through the movie. I was praying for an attack of deep vein thrombosis in my leg about 20 minutes in, so it could put me out of my misery. I was not a fan, just because I felt people who have actually gone to jail, and the whistleblowers and the human rights activists and the people who were tortured themselves accidentally, I just said, oh my God, this film just makes a mockery of that. It's a complete, you know, propaganda, revisionist history of it. All these opinions were edited out of my BuzzFeed piece, by the way. Right. Let me tell the story. But apparently, I wasn't wanted. They didn't want me to review it. But that was my response to it. It was pretty visceral, not unsurprising, but still disappointing.
You know, there was a real quality. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Clint Eastwood's, pre-1980 stuff, essentially. And there was sort of a Dirty Harry quality to it. But there's no doubt that Dirty Harry is a fictional movie. This was all about how the bureaucrats are leaning on us, and, you know, we're supposed to feel sympathy for the torture guy because he's seen too many naked bodies when he's headed. Yeah. I mean, honestly, yeah. I mean, there isn't even the slightest question as to whether or not what the message is being sent here from this film, whether or not it's intentional or not. The issue is, what hand did the CIA have, though, in developing this storyline? I mean, because this is.
Oh,
I mean,
well, here it is. Yeah, this is interesting. This is really interesting. I mean, look, like and you made the point about Dirty Harry, but also Dirty Harry movies were intentionally reactionary. You know,
yes.
I mean, they were actually quite thoughtful in what their political stance and view was going to be. You know, where this film seems to embrace the torture narrative because A, it's easier, it's sort of easy to portray dramatically. B, I don't think, you know, Sony as a corporation that's putting it out does not want to really do a film that has any sort of gray areas. You know, they don't want to get, you know, they don't want to, you know, seem like they're criticizing the guys who got bin Laden anyway at all. So I think that was there. And as you said, the third part of this is, what assistance did the filmmakers get from the CIA in shaping in when they were producing the movie? And we know for a fact that they had fairly extensive communications very early on in the process, within a month of bin Laden getting killed, I think 19 days of Bin Laden getting killed, the filmmakers are visiting the CIA headquarters and getting you know, essentially the CIA's version of the story. So that happens quite early on, and there's all these sort of emails documenting this. At one of the meetings, the screenwriter goes to this meeting with the CIA at the CIA headquarters, along with a Democratic consultant in public relations. You know, so you know, the people they were communicating originally with at the CIA were the public relations team. So obviously, you know, this is huge, and this is, you know, Mark Bohl, the filmmaker, who I liked Hurt Locker, and you know, I think a lot of his reporting is excellent, and I've never made a movie, and I'm, you know, who am I to say? But I will say this: I think one of the issues, and this is me speculating, is that, you know, as a journalist, your instinct often is to go with the best stuff, and I think the CIA probably gave them the best stuff, and they gave it to them first. And the movie sort of reflects that.
I mean, you know, what fascinates me about this is that, like, I have to imagine this is not the only group of people who were interested in making this movie, right? I mean, there was probably
tons of interest,
probably competing different factions. In fact, I think one of the CIA emails that has been recovered is like, these guys are the horse that we should bet on. Speaking
yep.
of
yes,
this,
exactly.
Now, because I think I raise this because I think to a certain extent it also dovetails with your book in some respects, because people should understand how this works here. If you've got, let's just say, arbitrarily, hypothetically, five different sort of producerial groups that are going to the CIA and say, we're going to tell this story. The CIA does not have to create a group that is going to tell the type of story they want. They just pick the one that they want. There's, you know,
exactly.
out of five choices, and so that's the horse we're going to go with. They're going to be more pliable. They're more willing to tell the story that we want to tell, which is one that whitewashes our involvement in it, and if anything, makes us sympathetic characters in the context of, you know, fighting against the bureaucrats and saving America from this boogeyman. And that is the way that propaganda is generated, and it's really, on some level, the same thing that happens on the campaign trail, right? Because they're not picking a specific correspondent. They're just waiting for the one that they want to show up.
Exactly. I mean, look, with this, you just ask yourself the question, right? If Oliver Stone had approached the CIA 19 days after the killing of Bin Laden,
right.
Do you think they would have, you know, said, oh, here, Oliver, come on in, and then we'll tell you everything? If Cy Hirsch, you know, investigative, you know, obviously, you know, major investigative journalist, had approached the CIA saying, hey, I'm doing this documentary with Jeremy Scale to tell this story of
right.
the Bin Laden, will you talk to us? yeah, maybe. But, you know, but with this, you know, obviously the Hurt Locker is very pro-military, very pro-U.S. policy. Without the Hurt Locker tries to sort of portray the Iraq War with no politics at all. I don't think it's successful in that. I think, in fact, that's a dodge by saying, oh, there's no politics in this movie that's taking place in Iraq as an action movie is a complete dodge.
Mm.
And as you said, with campaign journalism as well, you know, the campaigns are under no – now, the campaigns are more sort of a private institution, so rather than, say, a government-funded. But yeah, there's no – they pick their favorites, and those are the people who they're going to tell their story to. And if you are not one who's going to carry their water, you're not going to be the person they necessarily give everything to. That being said, I think there's still ways to tell the story, and part of the book, in fact, is you know, it's me going through. There's two narratives. There's like the third person behind the scenes narrative, and then there's sort of me going through trying to get access, trying to, you know, break into the Obama campaign and find out what's going on. And eventually that happened, but all after it was done. So that was sort of interesting.
All right. Well, yeah. So let's talk about that, because I think you know, I mean, it is. You, in terms of the Zero Dark 30 thing, you now have CIA, even CIA officials saying, well, this is a dramatization. This is not exactly how it happened, which, of course, is a sort of a wonderful, you know, sort of caveat to put at the end. I am sure everybody who goes to see that movie is going to be reading the words of the CIA spokesperson who says, well, this is just a dramatization. Exactly. Yeah, of course. And so as we see, you know, sort of the numbers go up in support of torture, not only, you know, the moralistic problems with torture, but efficacy problems with torture. This is why you get that. And on some level, it's also why you get such a sort of bastardized version of reality from the press, because those who are willing to tell the story of those in power will get the most access. And you're one of those people who's managed to do it you've been able to get that access, and to a certain extent, because you ended up telling a different story than they wanted, you know, particularly the operators, in many respects, exactly, you've been shut out of it.
And I'm pretty upfront, even with this campaign story. Look, like, you know, as I said, the Obama people won, right? So as I said to them, I said, look, you guys won. I want to do a book on the campaign and how you won. You know, there's no agenda besides sort of telling the story and getting into your heads and what you were thinking and how you were doing it, and try to get that in as much detail and, you know, kind of drama as possible. The last thing, just on this Zero Dark 30 point, and this is the last thing one of the things that really stuck out to me, and this is from reading Dan Frumkin and these other experts who really know what the interrogation room was like. If the interrogations that we did generally were very – they were supervised medically. You had, you know, guys essentially in lab coats, you know, the torture victims on gurneys. It was all videotaped, kind of in this emergency room, very clinical setting. Had they portrayed that in Zero Dark 30, the audience would have no sympathy for it, because they look like Nazis, because they look like, you know, this sort of sterilized, you know, experimenting with human life. It just looks so – horrible because it was so horrible,
right.
And I think that would have turned off people immediately. So they have to kind of make torture look like this sort of savage thing that we got involved with, which it is. But in fact, it was done in this very clinical, you know, strange, you know, like I use the N word, the Nazi word, but that's what it made. It's like a Kubrick film, you know.
Right.
If you show actually how they tortured, you all of a sudden you get Dr. Strangelove. You know, you get Clockwork Orange. You don't get Zero Dark 30.
Right. Well, I mean, the first torturer is essentially, you know, like a click above. You know, Sean Penn in Fast Times at Ridgemont High. You know, I'm the guy just going in there like, dude, just tell me what's going on or I'm going to have to hurt you again. And he's this guy is just sort of like he's got that. He's sort of a renegade. Right. I mean, you know, in the buddy cop film, he's the guy who's like, I'm just the crazy enough guy to do this. And in fact, it's far more about the message coming down. Do this. And it is far more about parameters being specifically lifted from these people so that they get this end result. It romanticizes torture in a multitude of ways, you know, in the same fashion that, like, you know, stop smoking campaigns get people to smoke more in some respects. Which is a story for a different day. But let's talk about Panic 2012. Why Panic 2012? This was... Was that centered basically on after the first debate?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, there is a bit of tongue-in-cheek nature to the idea of panic, right? Because panic in an election where, in the end, you know, President Obama won quite handily. But in the last 2 months, there was this atmosphere of total, you know, panic that was partly media generated, partly generated by the Romney campaign, and partly generated by you know, the Obama people themselves freaking out. And so the book opens in Las Vegas as they're preparing for the what becomes the catastrophic debate in Denver, and then brings us later inside the war room in Benghazi, which is also happening in this sort of really hotly contested election environment, and then ends with, you know, obviously the hurricane that comes in and the entire, you know, this sort of devastating storm where everyone, of course, very rightly, that's real panic. You know, you have a hurricane coming in. Along the way, the different ways that the media and the Obama campaign itself manipulated the fear of losing. Remember, you know, the Obama people love to say that they knew they were going to have it in the bag. You know, we knew we were winning the entire way. At the same time, you and I were getting emails every day saying, we're going to lose, give us money, we're going to lose, give us money. You know, so they can't, they're not totally blameless in terms of that there was this sort of sense of, this sort of intense sense of drama and sort of freak out.
Yeah, and of course, the media also needed to gin up a lot of that. But give us a sense about what what was going in. I mean, you talk about the advice that President Obama was getting going into that first debate.
Sure.
I was one of those people who felt pretty strongly as early as the beginning of this year, I guess, or last year, that President Obama was going to win. And I cannot tell you that after that first debate, I heard from like kids I went to school with in fourth grade just calling me out of the blue to say, like, is he going to win? What's going to happen here? I mean, that debate was sort of the drama point of the election. But what was the theory going into that debate for the Obama campaign?
Well, I mean, look, you know, the sort of theory of the case that I set out begins in Las Vegas, where essentially it's this very weird preparation for a debate at this, you know, bankrupt hotel. Can you hold on just one second?
Dog?
Have a dog running around. You know, it's this sort of bankrupt hotel in the middle of the desert. The atmosphere is you know, completely crazy. You know, so you know, it just.
Are you working with that dog? That's not Rick Scott's dog, Reagan.
Yeah,
Reagan, right.
Yeah, I got a puppy yesterday who's freaking out right now. So I'm trying to, you know, manage to talk about this at the same time. Make sure he doesn't destroy things. Anyway.
What kind of dog is it?
It's a corgi.
Nice little corgi puppy. All right, that's nice.
Yeah, exactly. So I apologize for being totally unprofessional. Usually I'm in the car or something. But it's completely sort of bad idea to go out to Vegas to do this.
On your part, you're the last guy I would think who would be able to deal with this. Frankly, I mean, with all due respect, I mean, just you know that. You don't necessarily fit the bill. I mean, you know, I perceive you as being having a slightly different attitude towards things than your average campaign reporter.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I'm coming at it sort of from this outside perspective, right? And that's the second part of the book. So again, we open in Vegas. You know, Obama goes to Denver. He totally blows it. He wasn't prepared. He was given bad advice by David Axelrod. He was given bad advice by another advisor.
What was the advice he was given? I mean, just
he was given Axelrod told him to go big, to speak, you know, speak to the American people, have a conversation with the Americans, you know. Not to actually debate. I mean, essentially, that the advice actually was don't debate. You know, to paraphrase it, and he didn't, and he was caught totally flat-footed. Plus, I think, you know, he'd gotten, you know, as everybody said, he'd gotten, you know, content with being president. You know, he was not used to being questioned like that. But anyway, after that, everybody, you know, you said you got calls from all your friends. Everybody freaked out. You know. The advisors to Obama were getting Tony Robbins called to offer advice.
Tony Robbins, the
Tony
guy.
Tony Robbins, the self-help guru, called to say, like, I need to be part of the debate prep team. You know, I can help you guys win. You know, so it was a complete freak out across the board.
Did they accept it? I mean, did Tony Robbins?
I don't think so. I think they were telling everybody to you know. Chill out, and then they got it. But it was a pretty, you know, at the end of it, at the end of the debate, you know, Obama went back to the White House eventually, and they really sat down, and you know, what did he do wrong? And he said, and according to sources I've talked to, he took responsibility, but also said, you know, you guys gave me some pretty bad advice.
Well, in some ways, I mean, that notion of staying above the fray and not engaging in sort of like the sort of the, I guess, the hand-to-hand wrestling in some respects was sort of not inconsistent with a lot of the way that he had been dealing with the Republicans back in 2010 and 2011.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. I mean, it was sort of a classic, you know, classic Obama moment. And you know, so that's one narrative of the debate. The other narrative of the story. The other is, as we discussed, as we sort of started to talk about, you know, I'm coming into this scene. I'm an outsider. I'm not part of the White House press corps. I'm not part of the traveling campaign press. And I'm kind of observing them. All, you know, reporting on them, it's pretty uncomfortable, but they sort of take me in, as I call it the mean girls effect, where, you know, and of course I'm portraying myself as a Lindsay Lohan in this scenario, where I show up, there's sort of this interest, and then at the and then you know, we become kind of friendly, I start to kind of like them, and then eventually I end up clashing with the White House and the White House press corps over a story I wrote there was a couple weeks left in the campaign. I wrote a story. They got so upset about this story that they threatened to throw me off the campaign plane.
Yeah. Now tell this is because you basically you reported on something that was supposedly off the record. Is that what it was?
Well, this is what they always say. It's crazy. So the exact details are at the end of beginning of September, after the DNC, Obama went down to Florida for a campaign tour. We got this email. One of the nights it said, hey, senior staff are going to have drinks with reporters at an off-the-record session. You know, so everybody's pretty, you know, okay, cool. And then as this, you know, drinks got closer, we started to hear whispers, oh, Obama himself is going to show up, which he never does. He really never really does. In fact, the last time he'd spend time with the campaign press like that apparently was 4 years ago. So it's a rare event. And he came down and he did his thing and talked to everybody and spent about an hour there, you know, kind of knocking back beers with reporters. Totally fine, right? Like, not a big deal. No one reported what he said or what was said there. But about a month after that happened, I just mentioned, oh, yeah, you know, Obama went down and did this, which actually is following the White House's own policy of these things. Because you're always supposed to note when there is an off-the-record session. You just don't say what happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I just mentioned it in a story, and all hell broke loose. You know, I got, you know, lectured by a Fox News correspondent and Ed Henry, the guy's name was, and you know,
what did Ed Henry have to tell you about?
yeah, Ed told me that I needed to start pretending that actual meeting with Obama never even existed. That if I was ever asked about it, I would have to pretend it did not exist. And then he said the other problem was that it you know, made everybody look bad because I reported it and other people didn't. Made
right.
Everybody look bad.
So, in other words, what it was is that even though the policy is that we should report that we're having off-the-record meetings with the president, where he is supposedly developing relationships, right, with the reporters, that's what
this
is about.
Exactly.
By
and
you telling their readers that they did this and them not telling it, it hurts their credibility with their readers, theoretically.
Yeah, exactly. No, the funny thing is, of course, no one outside of Ed Henry, myself, and the other 18 people on the bus even care.
Right. Well, that's the other thing, is that there's no group of Fox viewers out there going like, Ed Henry never told us about this. I mean, yeah,
so nobody is.
Right.
You know.
Well, it's just
so that was the funny thing. It was. I think at one point in the book, I say, "Oh my God, the stakes are so incredibly low here that we're fighting
yes.
over."
Yes. But is that also a function of how much of a bubble those people live in? Like, you know, like they think that that's a big story that somehow, I mean, it means that the audience for that to be a scandal is so small. It's really just sort of everybody just winking at each other in the room saying like, look, we all know, but we all have to pretend in some respects. Right. I mean, because he couldn't
right.
possibly be thinking this is going to hurt my credibility with people who read my stuff on FoxNews.com or something. Right. I mean, he's talking about this is going to hurt my credibility with the other 25 people who were there, too, that we all are part of this sort of group where we all sort of agree that, like, we're going to pretend to have this credibility.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. And I think, I mean, the funny thing at the At the end of this sort of speech that Ed Henry gave me, he said, well, you know, from now on you're going to be dealing with the White House because they're the ones who are going to punish you, basically. I'm paraphrasing here, but he said, you know, the White House is going to punish you for doing this. And so, sure enough, the White House, you know, calls up my editor and screams at them. Says, oh, hey, you know, hey, sings this and that. And literally my editor was like, are we really having this conversation? Like, are you guys high? But it was not – at the end of the day, it didn't matter that it was completely insignificant that this – you know, that Obama went down and hung out with reporters for a little bit. It was just about controlling the message and making sure that there was an obedient White House press corps mm-hmm. That followed the rules of a certain number of senior officials who kind of, you know, guide and shape the coverage. So it was legit. It was about control. It wasn't about, you know, oh my – you know, it wasn't about the sensitivity of the information. And there's also something to consider that the White House believes that just by allowing us to hang out with President Obama for an hour, our coverage will be more positive. That's interesting that they think that, and it might be true. So,
well, yeah, I mean, you know, that's what I was going to ask you is not so much in terms of the White House, because I think to a certain extent it is definitely true, and I wonder if even your the fact that your fellow correspondents took you in some respects, if that doesn't in any way shape your coverage of them. I mean, I think like there's a certain inevitability. There was Lexi Sayles, this comedian out of this crew of comedians in the 1980s in Britain, always had a saying about, you know, the problem with all his friends getting famous, those guys like, you know, the Rowan Atkinson, et cetera, that they become friends with Phil Collins and then you can't talk about how bad his music is anymore. There's some of that happens, yes?
Oh, for sure. I mean, look, I came in thinking, oh, I was going to hate these guys and, you know, wasn't going to like it and thought they were going to be all hacks. That's actually not – after spending time with them, I actually had a much more nuanced view. It may not get reflected in the coverage of the book, but I found these guys, you know, a lot of them to be actually, you know, I mean, this sounds even condescending saying this, but you know, they're obviously extremely talented, great journalists there. They're also really horrible journalists there. And even the portrait of Ed Henry, at least as I tried, it was trying to get, you know,
let's hear
Ed
the
Henry,
list.
Who's on which side of the? It's not just like a savaging of Ed Henry. It's,
right.
You know, I think a pretty, you know. More complicated picture of the guy where he's this sort of kind of good, you know, nice guy, fun to be around, really good with people, but also plays this kind of, you know, Washington insider game in a way that is problematic.
Right. And I mean, that on some level, it seems to me to be indicative of a lot of the press corps. Right. I mean, you're not going to succeed in that venue if you are a prickly type of person. I mean, if you're right. I mean, you have to be congenial and likable on some level. But at the end of the day, that's not really what you should be judged upon in terms of your role as a reporter.
No, exactly. And I think, like, you know, often too, when you're sort of dealing with these, there is a legitimate argument that the White House guys will make for this, the act, which is, look, the reason we do these things and agree to these onerous conditions is because we need to get close to these people because it helps our reporting and it helps us understand our reporting. The drawback is, well, and this is a conversation I've had multiple times, if all the best stuff we know and we learn, we're not allowed to say, we're not allowed to report, and in fact, we kind of just keep secret among ourselves and our editors, then how is that helping our reporting? And then you know, you're not helping your reporting, you're just pulling punches, you know, you're just getting co-opted.
I mean, this is the central dilemma that exists in the context of our media today. Maybe it's always been there, but balancing that platform and access versus actually why you're there in the first place.
Right. No, I think that's right. I think it's not, you know, I got into this screaming match with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal once on the plane. shockingly, you know, not getting along with everybody. And I got in a couple of screening matches. One, I was fucking dead drunk and don't recall the exact wording, but it wasn't kind. And this next one on the plane, we had actually this sort of fairly interesting debate that quickly degenerated into insults, but over this idea of court approval. And I was saying, you know, I was not a fan of it. And immediately I was, you know, criticized. You know, this Wall Street reporter kind of launched into me. And at the end of the day, after I said, oh, why don't you go hack a phone with Rupert Murdoch, we did come to this agree to disagree, you know, understanding, which was that, you know, we just had such radically different ideas of what it meant to be a reporter, you know.
But it's also you're representing a major threat to them too, I would assume. And it's like you know, I keep bringing up sort of like movies from the 70s, but you know, that was a big thing in Serpico, right? If you don't take the money the money that we get paid, nobody's going to trust you there. So I mean, if you somehow buck that that rule by the administration, you're threatening really all the other reporters in some respects.
Oh, for sure. And you would be shocked how many reporters came up to me throughout the campaign and just sort of like terrified, like, you're not going to write about what I say and do, are you? I'm like, well, you know, maybe, you know, like, oh, my God, how can you do that? It's like, well, you know, look, we're with campaign reporting, with political reporting, you're part of the story because we generate the story. We make the story. We shape the narrative. Therefore, you know, our behavior as members of the press should be subject to pretty intense scrutiny.
Do you when you're retelling that type of thing, do you in terms of your own code? I mean, for instance, is it as newsworthy that that dude goes up to the buffet way too many times and everybody's bummed that, you know, if you're behind him in line, you're not going to get any of the cantaloupe or whatever it is. Or is it, you know, will you just specifically stick to the dynamic that they have that ultimately informs their reporting? Or is it fair game to say, you know, that guy has the worst sort of – he never washed his hands when he left the bathroom.
He never washed his hands. Yeah, I probably wouldn't put in someone's name if I was going to make that observation. But look, I try – look, the reason I mentioned, you know, I think I only really write about one journalist by name, and that's Ed Henry. And that's because, look, he's the head of the White House – Correspondents Association. He's a public figure. He worked for CNN. Now he's at Fox News. And so he, in that role, he is more of a public figure,
right,
than just like Joe beat reporter, you know, who's you know, just trying to, you know, pay the bills and do their thing. So I, you know, I think, look, you want to be. I always try also, whoever I am sort of writing about, and especially if I'm doing it in a way that people might consider somewhat more critical, to be, you know, not just picky. I'm not trying to pick on anybody, you know. And if I am kind of, let's say, writing at length about Jay Carney, well, he's the White House press secretary, and these guys are big boys, and they can punch back,
right?
You know, and they do, and they will. So I try to play with it, you know, try to write with a sense of sort of fairness about, you know, I'm not going to, you know, look, one could easily, you see, you don't want. You could go around and write about, you know, oh, destroy some, you know, low-ranking Obama official, you know, really, you know, kick their – but what's the point of that? There's no point, and they're in it too in this sort of same way. But if you look at actually – but that's not necessarily the philosophy that a lot of political reporting operates on. I mean, you know, Politico, the venerable media website, mm-hmm. political website, you know, their biggest, you know, quote-unquote – you know, takedown was of like a 27-year-old, you know, spokesperson for Representative Daryl Issa. You know, those are the guys. They'll really kill those guys. You know, they'll give, you know, they'll flood the zone and, you know, destroy their careers. You know, people who are essentially, you know, helpless and
right, in no position to actually. There's no, yeah. I mean, that's just like a sacrificial lamb. You're not threatening any of the power structure there. But you're still making it look like you are non-sentimental, I guess.
Yeah, and then so I guess that's just my larger point. Whenever I'm trying to do this, I try to protect the innocent, so to speak, or at least the people who you should always, I think, be looking at the people in power, the people who have real influence. Those are the people I think worthy of giving them the, you know, the Close. Look, and again, doesn't
right.
I
and
mean, doesn't
then otherwise, you're just TMZ
positive.
At that point. I mean, maybe yeah. not even like I don't mean to knock TMZ. I have no idea. they may have an internal set of code of ethics that I don't know. I don't. But I'm just using that as an example. I don't want to get the TMZ people pissed at me.
Yeah, I know. They're going to be waiting outside your waiting room. And next thing you go through security at LAX, they'll be there.
That's right. I'm going to have to dress a little more appropriately. Well, Michael, it's great stuff. Panic 2012, the sublime and terrifying inside story of Obama's final campaign. It's available at bookstores everywhere, yes?
It's available right now in ebook only, but you can get it on your Kindle, your Nook, or iPad. And I'm pushing to get paper copies, but if your listeners, if you guys want to read it, please do. Appreciate all the support. Every sale really actually does make a big difference. And it just came out today, so a lot of good stuff, a lot of fun. It's entertaining. It's quick to read. People describe it as reading something like you've just taken Adderall. So
fantastic.
I took that as a compliment.
Well, we'll put a link up to it on our site at majority.fm. Thanks for coming by and talking to us. Good luck with that
great,
dog.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Good
thanks
luck
for putting
with
up
dog.
With the puppy, too. Talk
yes.
to you later.
All right, bye-bye. All right, folks. Went a little over today. Just a little house cleaning. Tomorrow, we'll be taking a tech day. Members will be getting an archive show. Non-members, I don't know what you're going to have. I don't know what you're going to do. Alex Jones, I guess. Coming up in the better half of the program. What, do we have a clip of Alex Jones? We do?
We do, yes.
Yeah,
we do.
We'll probably play that. Glenn Beck planning to build a gulch somewhere. The we'll talk maybe a little bit about the debt ceiling. President Obama's talk yesterday. Just, picking up on the Aaron Swartz story, there's just the incredible disproportionality and the zeal in which the federal prosecutors went after Aaron to make him an example, I think people are quite clear about, because beyond all proportionality, apparently, and we'll talk about this in the better half, apparently the one of Aaron's attorneys had made it clear to the U.S. prosecutors that Aaron was perhaps prone to suicide, and the response was just incredibly callous. You know, when you take into proportionality this situation, and particularly from a U.S. prosecutor who apparently had gone through something like this before, we'll talk more about that in the better half, just horrible, horrible. And we will get to that story of the Republicans having to have special training not to talk about rape in an offensive way. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. You can also support this program if you buy junk through Amazon. Buy it through our link. You will notice no difference. We will get a kickback. You can find that link at majority.fm/support-the-show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Give us a good review on iTunes. Maybe we'll do this next week because we have been short shrifting it. I don't even know what that word is. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll take your phone call, 646-257-3920. The IM is Majority FM. See you in a minute. Sitting up a pen.